I'm Rick Derderian, and this is Realms of Memory. University of Texas at Dallas art and cultural historian Erica Doss argues that we're living in an age of frenzied memorial making, from the victims of mass shootings, terrorist attacks, and the AIDS epidemic, to the memory of Black Revolutionary War patriots, Native American veterans, and civil rights leaders, the scope and breadth of memorials today seems almost unlimited. In Memorial Mania, Public Feeling in America, Erica Doss argues that present-day memorials embody public emotions, such as grief, fear, gratitude, shame, and anger. What do these emotion-based memorials reveal about Americans and America today? What are their limitations or potential as a means of understanding and working through difficult chapters from the past? To address these and other questions, I'm very pleased to welcome Erica Doss to discuss her book, Memorial Mania, Public Feeling in America. Erica, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
So I've heard you describe yourself as someone who isn't a contentious person, but somehow you spent a lot of your career gravitating to these really contentious subjects and how we engage with public art. So was there a moment in time where you became interested in this? Was there a particular case, instance when this sparked your interest?
That's a great question. I don't think I can pick a particular moment, but I will say that I've always been interested in public emotional displays. As an art historian, I'm always sort of surprised when the American public expresses an interest in or a dissatisfaction with American art, and American public art in particular seems to have been the target over the last couple of decades of frustration, anger, and all sorts of emotional responses. As an art historian, I guess what I'm particularly interested in then is reception, how people respond to and why people respond to public art among various other art objects and cultural objects in their midst. I mean, we live in a really complicated world in complicated times. And I gotta say, I'm always really surprised when people express an interest, an enthusiasm, or again, a dissatisfaction with public art or with cultural objects of all sorts.
You mentioned also that this, if there's been a frenzy of memorial making over the past decades, this isn't the first time this has happened, that we went through this at the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries. So you start your book with a comparison, trying to point out, well, what was the difference between that earlier period that you label as a period of statue mania and the current era of memorial mania? So they overlap in certain ways, but there's some significant and profound differences. So how would you compare the two eras?
Okay. So memorial making and monument building are not new. These have been concurrent with human existence on the planet. As long as we discover things that are literally thousands of years old. At the turn of the last century, in the late 19th century, in both the United States, but also in places like France and Germany and England, there was what we might call statue mania. And all of these nation states were sort of competing with one another to put up, erect, install, dedicate various statues. And these statues were mainly of great men and great historical events. And they were meant to, in a sense, educate or inculcate the masses about particular historical narratives. In other words, who is supposed to be important or great in American or French history? And who are the cultural icons of a particular time? And this was very much a sort of memorial making from top down. Your upper classes, your political heads are creating a sort of cultural and historical narrative for the masses. Get everybody in line, think alike. That's statue mania. I see memorial mania as different in that there's still that uptick in memorial making and probably more because of technology and all sorts of other factors. But the difference is that it is both a combination of top-down, but also grassroots memorial making and monument building. You have a lot of different groups, publics, interest, who are pursuing memorial making, and it isn't just a top-down endeavor.
So it's less the state targeting a public than it is the, I mean, that still is going on today, but you have the publics also crafting their own narratives of themselves.
Absolutely. And they're doing so particularly in the United States, which is the subject of the material I work on, because of what I talk about and what others have talked about in terms of rights and you know, the sense in which we have the right as Americans, a sort of democratic evolution, we have the right to craft our own narrative. Present and represent our own history. And those histories, those narratives can vary and do vary from select groups.
So if these narratives in the present and what drives Memorial Mania has this grassroots bottom-up dimension, I've heard you mention elsewhere that this is really an outgrowth of the civil rights era, the 1960s, the changes that happened at a particular moment in time.
Absolutely. The civil rights era is instrumental in terms of a consciousness raising among all Americans about what are rights? What am I entitled to as a citizen of the United States? And, you know, folks look around and they look at the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and they question why that mall is so full, first of all, of war memorials, and second, so full of memorials to white men, you know, the great leaders of the past. So there have been efforts over and over to challenge or perhaps elaborate, expand on those particular cultural and historical narratives. And one of the more successful of the memorials built in the last couple of decades is the memorial to Martin Luther King Jr., which is on the edge of the National Mall, but certainly still counts as part of National Mall memory.
So if you're going to look at what drives memorial making today, you focus on these five emotions that you mentioned before: grief, fear, gratitude, shame, and anger. They're the drivers. They're a big part of the responses to memorial making. And you begin your book with a discussion of grief, and you focus on incidents of grassroots memorial making, connection with school shootings. And you spend most of the chapter, a lot of the chapter, talking about the Columbine mass shooting in 1999. So if you look at the memorial making that happens after Columbine, what insights does this give us into how these kinds of spontaneous grassroots memorials help us deal with the shock, the grief of, that happens after these kinds of sudden atrocities?
Yeah, that's a good question. Every chapter of Memorial Mania is a case study around a particular emotion, grief, for example, shame, anger, gratitude. And in the grief chapter, I focused on the Columbine school shooting, which took place in 1999. I was then teaching at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and I had the opportunity then to visit that shrine as it unfolded over a period of weeks following those murders in the spring of 1999. And I was shocked at the incredible public outburst of, in a sense, memorial making themselves. People from all over the nation came to this site right outside of Denver and began creating this enormous shrine site or memorial site full of notes, cards, balloons, flowers, teddy bears. A lot of people put personal items on the cars of the slain students and teachers in the school parking lot. And it became this sort of collective funerary space, this collective space of mourning and grief. So I really wanted to investigate why people were doing this, why they were encouraged to do this, and what they were going to get out of it all. So ostensibly, as I argue in the book, people came together in genuine shock and grief over the deaths of these young students and the teacher and ultimately the murderers themselves. And it led in part to calls then, and we continue to see those today, for gun control, you know, for a serious reconsideration of the presence, the availability, and the use of guns in this country. There were rallies that were held immediately following Columbine. There was discussion about gun control. And interestingly enough, the NRA was having its national convention in Denver shortly after the Columbine murder. And there was hope among a lot of people that let's not do this again. Let's have an end to particularly school shootings. So on the one hand, I was very optimistic about that. But it didn't happen. I mean, that was 1999, and we've continued to see again and again school shootings and, you know, mass murder in this country because of gun. So I wrote the chapter thinking about the possibilities of emotional responses that are involved with memorial making and the possibility for this particular shrine site, and ultimately a permanent memorial was built right outside the school at Columbine. The possibilities were, in a sense, stilled or stalled. And I found that really interesting. In other words, people came out and they grieved and they mourned and they cried. But that grief itself did not translate into a transformative political action. And I took that to task. In other words, I think it's fine. I think it's great that Americans have, in a sense, used public displays of grief and mourning to vent their outrage, to vent their frustration. But they haven't pushed themselves to the next step so that they don't have to grieve and our children don't have to die in political action. So in that particular chapter, I ended on sort of a depressing note about the failure of American publics to, in a sense, stay in grief modes or mourning modes, but not go to the next step, which is to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Because this is an example of a form of public art that it creates a democratic space for conversations around a serious national issue. And those conversations don't seem to unfold, at least not in any constructive, lasting way. And I thought what was really interesting about that chapter is that you point out it gets hijacked for other purposes, an effort on the part of Christian evangelicals to kind of lay claim and spin it in their own way.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Christian evangelicals and others took a very different stand. And I'm not saying that they are not uniformly opposed to gun control, but instead this became sort of a place and a space that was all about discussions about Christian evangelists. And I thought, you know, that's kind of odd as well, because there's an assumption then that these kids and this teacher were, in a sense, Christian martyrs. And that, in a sense, is an easy out, because that sort of ends the conversation right there. Instead of, as I think would be much more efficacious for the country, a consideration of why they died in the first place.
Mm. And I thought that was a big point that you made. If you're really trying to understand, well, clearly these temporary spontaneous memorials that follow these tragedies, they give people a chance to participate collectively in the public sphere, to grieve together. And that there are benefits to that.
Absolutely. It certainly does. And I think in a sense, that's why it's encouraged. I mean, it's much better for people to come together in these spaces and grieve and mourn with the material culture and the visual culture of the shrines that they create than, for example, march in the streets, burn down police stations, you know, engage in a sort of anarchic, angry response to chaos in their midst. You know, they absolutely serve a purpose of, if you will, harnessing American grief and mourning in particular spaces and places. And I think people need to recognize that. So I'm not saying that Americans or others, because this is a worldwide, a global phenomenon. When tragedies and traumas take place, we almost immediately see the making of what I call spontaneous shrine sites. This is a big shift from sort of holding in or disguising one's personal feelings of grief and mourning and taking them outside, making them public. But on the other hand, it is sort of a stopgap measure. We grieve, we mourn, and mass murder continues. Or in the case of, you know, the unfolding of the Black Lives Matter movement, people of color are continued to be killed by, police and others.
Okay. And this seems to be a recurring theme throughout the book, that when you talk about the limitations of different types of emotion-based memorials, that often they don't do a lot in terms of helping us to understand the hows and the whys. Right? That seems to be the case here with Columbine, that there's this outpouring, literally hundreds of thousands of material things that you stress that are brought to this site to help people express their grief. But when it comes to actually trying to understand, well, how did this happen? How do we prevent this in the future? There's not a whole lot there that's useful to people.
Right. It becomes just sort of this outlet for grief and mourning. And there's been a lot of criticism of that. When Princess Diana died, for example, there were so many op-eds and conversations about, oh, this display of grief is just unseemly. But it was very telling. I mean, she was a beloved figure. Her death was deemed a tragedy, an unnecessary tragedy. And the expression of grief and mourning in England and then around the world was very telling. But that, I think, is sort of a different example of the school shooting at Columbine or the various other school shootings. I would just like to see a transformative understanding so that people don't stay stuck, if you will, in grief and mourning, and actually take that grief, take that mourning, and make it such that it doesn't happen again.
So you mentioned many of the conclusions that you draw from many of the chapters and many of the examples of emotion-based memorials are a little bit on the depressing side. It's how these events get used, manipulated. There's a limited understanding of what's going on behind. But then in each chapter, you're trying to offer other examples of other ways of doing this that seem to have more promise. And I think the AIDS quilt is the example that you give in this particular chapter, that this is maybe another way of expressing grief more constructively.
Absolutely. The names quilt, or the AIDS quilt, as it is called, was constructed for exactly those reasons. How could a population respond to the tragedy of AIDS, the loss of tens of thousands of people, and do so in a way that both allowed for grief, but also made it known that the ways in which people with AIDS were initially treated, the lack of government and medical response, the sense in which folks were ostracized, that was not only not appropriate, so it was absolutely unethical. So the AIDS quilt remains a twofold sort of project. On the one hand, it is a project that allows people to contribute, making individual personal pieces of a very large quilt in memory of those who died. And secondly, it is very much a consciousness-raising project, very much political project that is about calling Americans to task and calling everybody to task to think about why these people died and what the response was at the time. An extraordinary project, now too big to be displayed in a single place, but archived and maintained, seen by millions and millions of people, and sections of the quilt are still shown in school auditoriums and city hall spaces, that it had this sort of political purpose, historical narrative to it. And that's a great example, I think, of what I call the potential, the transformative political potential of grief and mourning in American public spaces.
So if we turn to your chapter on fear, and fear is something that's this pervasive emotion, especially after 9/11, but even before with the Oklahoma City bombing. And those are the two examples of memorials, the prominent examples in that part of your book where, that you feature to talk about how memorials respond to our fears, our sense of insecurity. And you stress that they do so in terms of a security narrative or security narratives that have certain elements to them. So what are these security narratives that help us cope with or regain a sense of security after these types of events?
Yeah, the security narrative actually doesn't help us regain a sense of security. It makes us more afraid. And so it was interesting, following 9/11, almost immediately, within 24 hours, there were discussions in the mainstream media about how this event was going to be memorialized, which kind of surprised me. But sure enough, almost immediately, people started arriving in New York City and tugging off and tugging away huge pieces of the former metal framework of the World Trade Center buildings, and then taking those, those warped and damaged pieces of steel back to their hometowns all over the country and making their own memorials. So it was interesting to me that these events, and particularly the event that took place in New York City, was claimed as an event that took place in the entire nation and was memorialized in those terms. Now, why? I was really interested in why somebody from Illinois or California or Arizona would take the trip, the time to go to New York to gather up these materials and then go back to their hometown and put together a 9/11 memorial. And over 1,000 9/11 memorials were built from 2001 to the present day. Also, hundreds of 9/11 memorials have been built around the world, which is also interesting. Why were they built? Well, on the one hand, of course, they were built to pay homage, to pay respect to those who were killed during 9/11. And they were also, in a sense, used to make them sort of national martyrs. Almost immediately, we become involved in the War on Terror, which spreads and goes on for quite some time. So what's interesting about this security narrative is that these memorials are meant to ease the trauma or help take care of the fear that Americans have about terrorism, the unexpected. But I don't think they work that way. If anything, they heighten a sense of dread and fear. And in a sense, that plays into the hands of those who want us to stay always on edge, always afraid, worried about security, and in a sense, be insecure. And so we buy into particular narratives about threats, about foreign others disrupting an American way of life, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm. Okay. And you talk about the ways in which these memorials are constructed and the significance of minimalist architecture, modern architecture as the most prominent way in which memorials are built today, and how the ways in which this architecture can give people a sense of order or stability that terrorist attacks take away from them.
Yeah, minimalism, and I think one of the best examples of the minimalist aesthetic or minimal aesthetic would be Maya Lin's Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which was installed in the early 1980s on the National Mall. Minimalism, and if you know that memorial, it's It's not very large, sort of low to the ground, very accessible because we see ourselves reflected in the highly polished black granite. Minimalism can be seen as sort of a blank slate. And we can, in a sense, project our feelings onto that slate. We can think about it from multiple interpretations. Maya Lin designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial to emphasize the pain, the deaths, the suffering of American soldiers. And that's exactly why the piece was commissioned in the first place. It became so controversial and became so recognized that the style was realized in multiple other memorials that are striving, as she strived, to create this sort of emotional response. In other words, instead of just walking by that memorial or monument in your midst, in front of the city hall or in a park, Maya Lin and other memorial makers today really want people to experience the project. So the emphasis in that project and others is on felt experience, and minimalism allows that. Whereas other memorials might have details, craft details, or other kinds of details, stylistic details that might prevent someone from doing that, people believe that the blank slate of the minimalist object or the minimalist memorial allows people to project thoughts onto it. So it's not surprising that it's become sort of the go-to style for a lot of these memorials that are made today.
Hmm. And maybe this was more the point you made with the Oklahoma City National Memorial. I thought you were trying to make a point that the way they're structured in a therapeutic way, the way they take you through the experience, the messages that you process as you walk through the gates, they're aimed at this goal of helping you to come to terms with what happened, at closure.
I think that's definitely part of it with both the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and with Oklahoma City's memorial. With Vietnam Veterans Memorial, you walk down a pathway into the vortex and then you walk out. So in a sense, you walk in and you walk out. And either way, you walk into the darkness and then you walk into the light. And she purposely put together that very V-shaped sort of design to have people do that. So that's what I mean by a sort of felt experience, the performative aspects of the memorial. And in so doing, you walk past all the names and then you walk out. So there is a sense of absorbing and seeing yourself reflected in those names and then walking out into the real world or the world. Oklahoma City is somewhat the same. You walk into the space through two gigantic, highly polished gates, and inside are the 168 chairs that are placed more or less where the bodies of those who died in that explosion were found. The building, in a sense, conceptually tipped on its side. You can walk through them, walk on a path around them, recognize what they are, and then again, walk out of that space. So it's contained. And you walk in and you walk out. And that's what I mean by those sorts of therapeutic conditions. There's very much the emphasis on you feeling that trauma. Although, of course, we can never feel that trauma in the way that those who died in those, died in those memorial events themselves can. And then you walk out. And I think that therapeutic ethos is reflected in quite a few of these minimalist design public art projects.
But again, if you're trying to understand what was behind the Oklahoma City bombing or the 9/11 attack, that the way in which these memorials are constructed doesn't do a whole lot to deepen our understanding.
Oh, I agree with you completely. The interesting thing about Oklahoma City is you've got the 168 chairs, you've got the big gates, and if you really want to know what happened, you have to go into the museum. And the Oklahoma City Museum is fascinating. And I will say, I've been there quite a few times, and it's changed its narrative over the years. I mean, at first it was all about, it was all about Timothy McVeigh's horrible act of terrorism. But today, my most recent visit, the memorial, in a sense, after you walk through all the historical aspects, has this interesting space where visitors are invited to put headphones on and sit in front of computers and then answer and respond to a bunch of questions, which include questions about, well, what would you do if a friend of yours or a family member said that they wanted to, participate in a terrorist bombing? You know, what would you do? How would you respond? In other words, it puts people into the place of having to make ethical, informed decisions. And I think that's great. But that's what a museum does. A memorial can't quite do that, nor necessarily should it be expected to do so.
Okay. So your chapter on gratitude centers on World War II, this World War II generation, the National World War II Memorial in the Washington Mall, and this notion that there hadn't been sufficient gratitude expressed towards this generation in the lead up to the funding and the building of this in the early 2000s. Where did this idea come from? I think you point out that this was a completely inaccurate idea that there hadn't been an acknowledgement and expression of gratitude earlier on. Why was there this forgetting of what had happened earlier?
Yeah. Why was there this forgetting indeed? And I think that's a really good place to start in terms of, memorials are made because of forgetting. Memorials are made because we're afraid of cultural amnesia. And in this case, the making of the National World War II Memorial, which was dedicated in 2004 in Washington, was very much, in my opinion, the making of a memorial so that cultural amnesia about World War II and the Greatest Generation would never happen. I was fascinated by the suggestion or the idea that was repeated over and over again that the World War II generation had never been properly acknowledged, or there wasn't a World War II memorial. And I seemed to think, wait a minute, what are you talking about? What is that big Arlington Cemetery memorial? It may be for the U.S. Marine Corps, but I mean, when I think World War II memorialization, that's the first example that comes to mind. And then the more I delved into this, I realized, of course, there were memorials and monuments that were built after World War II, but they took a different form. Some of them were auditoriums or arenas or parks and recreation facilities, because a lot of people were like, we do not need any more monuments of generals on horseback. What we need are living monuments so that we can actually translate our grief into living spaces for the generation now and the generation to come. So the idea of memory or memorialization changed a little bit. This wasn't complete, but there were lots and lots of World War II memorials. Another example of World War II memorials is that a lot of towns around America put the planes and the tanks from that war in parks or in front of city halls. So, World War II was memorialized. So that brings us to why then do they build this gigantic memorial on the Mall, which was dedicated, as I said, in 2004. And the reasons for that, I think, have to do with those who particularly promoted it, including George Bush and Tom Hanks, who, in a sense, had not participated in World War II. They were not World War II soldiers, although Tom Hanks was a movie actor who was in a movie about World War II. So there was, in a sense, a guilt, perhaps, or a desire to honor their parents, their father's generation. So this became sort of a leading quest or a leading point of discussion in the making of the memorial. And it was meant to absolutely contrast or challenge the popularity or the visibility, if you will, of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. In a sense, there was, we have to make a memorial that's about the real war of the 20th century, the one that Americans won, the one that Americans were victorious in, rather than the Vietnam War. So all of these things sort of filtered into the making of this memorial. I attended the dedication in 2004, and I interviewed quite a few World War II vets and asked them what they felt about this memorial. And it was interesting. Lots of them said, this isn't what I expected. This isn't what I fought for. This looks like more that's something that Speer would have designed in Germany in the 1930s or early 40s for the Third Reich. This is over the top. It's overblown. A lot of other vets were sort of surprised that the memorial emphasizes the American role. There is little or no mention of the fact that this war was fought in Europe and was really about allies, and it was an allied effort. But nevertheless, it's there, it's right there on the National Mall, right in the middle. It's interesting, if you visit it, how the memorial that remains the most visited, and I use the word popular, but that's not quite what I mean, is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And people sort of walk in to the National World War II Memorial, and they take a look at the gigantic columns and the huge pools of water. And they spend a few minutes and they walk out. It is not a particularly introspective or reflective space, unlike the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
If anything, it seems to be a throwback to that earlier era of memorials, right? That it's a classical style, classical symbolism. You point out that a lot of people will look at the symbolism. They just don't have the means to even understand it.
They don't. And it is definitely a sort of, you know, neoclassical modern approach to memorial building. And people struggle to have some sort of personal connection with the memorial. And what they do most often is they find the column among the column states, the columns that are designated by a particular state, and they pose in front of that state column, for example, Montana or Wisconsin. And then that becomes their personal connection with that memorial. But, you know, again, that is, it's really sort of an odd personal connection.
Mm. And again, to the extent to which, you know, you have this massive expense, a central location in the mall, and does it really help us understand that conflict? And you pointed out that it really casts in a very narrow, limited way, which I couldn't help thinking of when I was watching the recent Apple TV series Masters of the Air about American bombers in Europe. Just seemed to fit perfectly into your description of how the war was intended to be understood through that memorial, and how that's similar in lots of popular culture, movie, and TV examples.
Yeah, it's definitely a triumphalist example of public art. And that's a problem because, yeah, it was an Allied victory, but the trauma, the chaos, the devastation that war left for millions, including Americans, has never, been thoroughly tackled. Soldiers came home shell-shocked. Trauma was real. And instead, it all sort of gets glossed over as this wonderful triumph. And, you know, it's more complicated than that. I guess what worries me the most about that project and so many of the war memorials in this country is this unrelenting militarism, you know, this emphasis on war. And war memorials, in fact, are the largest number of memorials that are built in this country. And what does that tell us? And what does that tell us about how we feel about ourselves or how we identify or understand ourselves? And I find that incredibly depressing.
And the understanding, you point out, that it's often given, well, how do we understand wars? What are they about? Why do we fight them? Freedom. Freedom is the one word that explains it all.
Right. I think it's freedom disguised in so many different ways, but whatever. You know, you talk to any soldier who's actually been in wartime and they will just scoff at these memorials. You know, they I don't need a memorial. I need VA benefits. I need the country to understand that you have to stop sending us over into places of danger and devastation, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. But again, you conclude that chapter and you point out that there are other ways of memorializing the victims of war without celebrating war.
Yeah. And of course, so many of those are going to be about projects that are anti-war and projects that take into account that Americans go to war for a variety of different reasons, but you know, there are different ways of responding to both the soldiers and the citizens. So I end that chapter by talking about both how so many journalists and others compared the National World War II Memorial with the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. But I also talked about projects like Arlington West, which is a project that took place in Santa Monica, California, talking about, in a sense, the soldiers and why they died, and particularly U.S. soldiers who were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan during the War on Terror. And this consisted of some 340 small wooden crosses on a beach in front of a wharf in Santa Monica. And the motivation here was, of course, to protest the war on terror, but also to be honest about what the impact of war is on human beings. I thought it was a really powerful project. Another really powerful project was the Eyes Wide Open project, which took place in a couple of different cities and consisted of lines and rows of boots, soldier boots lined up in front of, for example, the state capitol in Denver. Again, talking about who actually dies in these wars? You know, what is the experience of wartime? And it isn't all triumph. You know, we need to be so much more circumspect about why we go to war and why we go to war so easily.
Okay. So if we turn to the emotion of shame, and this has really been in the news recently, and you know, how do we, have been laws that have been passed in states about trying to minimize how we teach shameful chapters to kids in the classroom, debates over 1619 project and discussions about how much of this is beneficial for the nation. And I think you point out that they're really historically, shame has not been prominently featured in American memorial culture, and this is a recent development. So what drives this development? What makes shame such a difficult topic to do constructively? I think you mentioned it's the Duluth lynching memorial that does a pretty good job of addressing a shameful chapter in a way that it really helps people to understand and promotes accountability and social cohesion. But in many other instances, this doesn't happen. There are a lot of slave memorials, for example, that don't really get the job done as well.
Yeah, it is an important emotion. It is not something that people are comfortable with. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm ashamed is something that you talk about. You know, we tend to hide our shame in many cases. But what I wanted to do in this chapter was talk about national shame and our, you know, our refusal in a sense as a nation to reckon with shame. And I started with the Duluth Lynching Memorial, which was an incredible history for me to explore. But the lynching memorial that was dedicated in Duluth, Minnesota in 2003 was about a lynching of three African-American men that took place in 1920. And, you know, I was thinking Duluth, Minnesota, lynching. I thought this was a Southern phenomenon. So this was a great project for me in being able to recognize and explore the incredible history of racial terrorism that we, again, have, you know, only recently in American history and American culture at large sort of begun to maybe reckon with. So I start off talking about this project and why it was made. I talk about it in terms of shame. And I think that the reason we haven't really talked about these American episodes of shame is because, you know, we're a country that is supposed to be about exceptionalism and progress and reform. And, you know, we have this triumphal national history. And anything that conflicts with that conflicts with this larger understanding of America as the land of opportunity, the American dream. But in the last few decades, American history, American historians, and I think the American public at large, you know, have increasingly recognized the contradictions and complexities of those assumptions about triumph and exceptionalism. And for those of us who are still interested in the democratic equity project, you know, the more perfect union idea, coming to terms with past shame is necessary in order to prevent future shame. And that includes dealing with the 400 years of slavery and the ongoing episodes and sort of assumptions about racial terrorism. So this chapter, you know, was important to me in terms of how we prefer a national memory or a national narrative that isn't shameful, but the facts of the matter are there have been many shameful instances, episodes in American history. How do we deal with that?
So if you take an example of Duluth, I mean, how does it, it seems like part of the success is that you get buy-in, you get people to, they're involved in this project, the community gets involved, and this works in a way, the way it's structured, it really encourages people to stop and reflect, to think critically, to take ownership. How does it do this? And why doesn't this happen in other instances?
It is absolutely about public buy-in. And I think that, you know, any public artist who is interested in reception and, you know, guiding people to a particular outcome has to be involved from the get-go with the public or the multiple publics that will respond to or, you know, visit the particular public memorial site. So in Duluth, the project started small. So many projects do. A woman walked by the space in Duluth where these three young men had been murdered in 1920. She walked by every day, and she began to get bits and pieces of the original story. Basically, they were part of a traveling circus, which had stopped in Duluth for a day. One of the members of the basic African-American crew was accused of sexual molestation, a sexual assault. All of this was completely fabricated. But several of the men in the crew were arrested and put into the downtown Duluth jail. And that night, 10,000 people, that was a tenth of Duluth's population at the time, seized the jail, grabbed three of the eight men, and then hung them from a light pole about a block and a half away from the jail. The next day there were photographs taken of lynched men, but the next day there were photographs, of kids around the light pole. In other words, this got a lot of visual, attention in newspapers all over the country, but it disappeared from Duluth's consciousness, you know, this horrible thing that happened until, 80 years later, when a reporter for one of the Duluth newspapers sort of revived the story, began asking questions about what happened. And doing so, by the way, because there were episodes at the time of racial tensions in Duluth. So She helped organize a poet and an artist and other people who wanted to create a small, modest park across the street from where the lynching took place. And that's what developed as the Duluth Lynching Memorial. In order to get buy-in, she and others, the artist in particular, talked to school groups, various civic groups, the mayor, all sorts of folks, such that to this day, there are annual celebrations or annual rituals that take place at the site. The site is also used in public school classes as a place to visit to talk about American race relations and racial terrorism. And so it has this degree of public buy-in, public support that keeps it meaningful in that particular community. In other words, you know, we tend to often put public art up, public memorials up, and then walk away going, done. But in order to keep the memory of the event alive, why it happened, why it's meaningful, how important it is, you have to have this kind of public buy-in. And I think Duluth does a really good job.
And I thought your point about the slave memorials is that there's not a whole lot of critical thinking that it promotes, that there's this larger narrative of overcoming that's emphasized, that doesn't really encourage you to reflect on the particulars of the past.
Absolutely. In some of the earlier slave memorials, this was, you know, this is a problem, and it's something that we have not resolved, which is a lot of groups do not want to see their painful, horrible past, you know, realized in bronze and stone, and would much rather see a triumphal, successful historical narrative. And so many of the slavery memorials, and I'm thinking of one in particular in Savannah, feature African-American families with only a hint, with the shackles around their ankles, of an earlier history or earlier treatment. Now, since I wrote Memorial Mania, things have changed considerably. So one of the most impressive memorials about racial terrorism is the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. And this is an incredible memorial dedicated in 2018 to the lynching victims, over 4,500 lynching victims in the United States. And the piece consists of a very, very large horizontal spread on top of an area that was formerly a slave warehouse about a mile from downtown Montgomery. In other words, a place where slaves were held until they were sold. Very long horizontal spread, a building, and also a memorial space that consists of stelas or large corten steel pieces of steel. And on them are written, inscribed, the towns and names where these lynchings took place. And they both are on the floor or hanging from the ceiling. The entire building is filled with them. And you walk through and you are surrounded by these names and these places. And then outside, they are duplicated. And people from the communities where these lynchings took place are encouraged to take one. You'd have to get a, you know, a flatbed truck, but to take one back to their hometowns and erect their own lynching memorial. In other words, it's a very proactive, visible sort of a memorial, which gets at the incredible sense of how much lynching there was, how much racial terrorism there was, but also calls on people in local communities to continue thinking about and erect their own memorials in their own hometowns. In other words, claim your history and reckon with it today.
Okay. So clearly, memorial statues in particular have been the target of a lot of anger, a lot of toppling and destruction of statues in recent times. And seems to be the subject of your recent work, that memorials or monuments, they have a lifespan. They lose meaning. They can generate a backlash. They might need to be replaced by something else. We might need to rethink how we memorialize the past. So what is it that triggers anger? What is it about memorials that can spark anger? What does this anger reveal about them? What do we do with these disgraced or troubling memorials or monuments?
That is a great question, and one that I continue to ask myself. I mean, I think that memorial mania continues today, but I think it's changed because I think memorial mania includes today the sort of what we might call deconstructionist project of thinking about challenging and sometimes removing memorials in our midst that people find offensive, people find objectionable, or absolutely inappropriate in terms of upholding the values that we currently believe in. So what I'm thinking about now is memorials have a lifespan. All things live and die. And that includes memorials and monuments. And that's hard for people to hear. Although I ask them to think about, well, you know, what about your car, your house, your clothes? I mean, we cycle through things. Why wouldn't we cycle through memorials and monuments as well? I mean, I'm really challenging then, and I think a lot of Americans are challenging the idea of permanence, particularly when it comes to that permanent fixed memorial in our midst. And that doesn't mean I am, you know, in favor of some sort of planned obsolescence scheme when it comes to memorial making. But I do think that we need to be really cautious about what we put up. And maybe the idea of the temporary or the ephemeral memorial is something we really ought to be engaging with more. I mean, one of the ideas that I think is really worth considering is the fourth plinth idea in London, where there are four plinths in Trafalgar Square. One of them was never filled, if you will. And so it becomes the site for an ever-changing public art display. Some things are up for a few months, some things are up for 6 months, but no matter what it is, it has a temporality to it. And I think that allows for political and social ideas that people might be intolerant about if it was going to be permanent. But because we realize, oh, that's only going to be up for a little while, I wonder what will be next. It allows for an incredible sort of display, and it allows for all sorts of ways of thinking about, the idea of memorialization in general.
I was watching this program on the environment. It had to do with construction and buildings, and how the problem with buildings, they generate so much environmental waste, and part of it is because they're built with this idea that they're going to last forever, and we really should build them in a way in which it becomes easier in the future to take them apart so we can rebuild them, reuse the materials and build them in another way, in a healthier way that's more suitable to whatever the conditions are.
Yeah, I think we're absolutely heading in that direction, particularly in terms of resource management. I'm very interested then in what do we do with memorials that we topple, that we take down? I'm interested in the idea of ruins. There are these amazing sort of ruined cultural heritage parks that have sprung up all over the planet in former Soviet states and also in Taiwan and in India. We could be doing much the same. And, ruins can also be a source of future memorial projects. I think these are all going to be part of our reckoning with the idea of permanence and new ways of thinking about memory and history in the future.
Erica Doss, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Erica Doss is the Edith O'Donnell Distinguished Chair in the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History at the University of Texas at Dallas. She spent decades researching and publishing on how Americans engage with public art. I've been talking with her today about her book, Memorial Mania, Public Feeling in America. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or review us on your favorite podcast app. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.